from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
It's a very complex activity, believe me, and I don't enjoy it all the time. When I do enjoy it, it's marvelous.
That's the late Northern California artist Richard Diebenkorn speaking about his relationship to painting. A new exhibit at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art explores the inspiration that he found in the works of Henri Matisse. We'll discuss the ways in which Diebenkorn incorporated Matisse's style, techniques, and color in his own paintings with the exhibit's co-curator and the head of the archives at the Richard Diebenkorn Foundation. It's all coming up on Forum after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. A new exhibit at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art explores the relationship between two artists who never met, the Bay Area figurative artist Richard Diebenkorn and the French post-impressionist Henri Matisse. Although Diebenkorn was born 50 years after Matisse, he had an enduring fascination with the older painter. Diebenkorn incorporated Matisse's technique, style, and use of color into his paintings and often traveled as far as St. Petersburg and Paris to view Matisse's work. We're going to discuss the exhibit, the lives of the two artists, and how, side by side, their work tells a story of study and inspiration in this hour. Joining me in the studio are Janet Bishop, Thomas Weisel, family curator of painting and sculpture at the SF MoMA and curator of the exhibit. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Michael.
Good to have you, and congratulations, by the way, on the curating, which was, as I've been telling people, quite well done, stunningly done. Daisy Murray Holman, also with us, heads the archives at the Richard Diebenkorn Foundation. And welcome. Good to have you with us as well.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you both. And Janet, let me begin with you. This is, well, as I said earlier, turn of the century, half century apart, both love color. You've got 40 Matisse's, 60 Diebenkorn. Many of them, I should say, before I go to you, are on our website, kqed.org/forum, and you can see how some of this is laid out. And I'd love to hear from listeners in terms of responses to actually viewing paintings, especially people who have, well, the good eyes that many of you do when it comes to discerning critically what paintings convey to you or how you even judge them. Profound inspiration is what we're talking about here, aren't we, in terms of the Matisse's effect?
Yes.
So, talk about that.
Well, Richard Diebenkorn first encountered Matisse's work when he was a Stanford undergraduate, and he sought it out at every opportunity from that point forward, whether in private collections or museum exhibitions, even in catalogs. And what's so interesting to me is the way that he was able to take what he saw in Matisse's work and really make it his own. I think in the hands of a lesser painter, the interest wouldn't be nearly so interesting. But the way that he absorbed what he saw in Matisse's work and applied it to his own paintings crops up in all kinds of really fascinating ways.
And Daisy Holman, Daisy Murray Holman, this first sighting that Janet referred to was in Palo Alto. It was the home of Sarah Stein, who was the sister-in-law of Gertrude Stein, wife of Michael Stein. He also saw some Picasso and Matisse there, but went on to actually see more Matisse's. Went on to see more Matisse's in all kinds of other places. At this point, though, I mean, early on, when you examine Diebenkorn's work, you're seeing someone who is more of a realist, influenced by, say, Edward Hopper, artists like that, yeah?
Yes. Diebenkorn was at Stanford when he first encountered Matisse in person at Sarah Stein's house. And it really struck him that Matisse could use paint in the way that he did and use color, and that he was so beloved by Sarah Stein, I think made a huge impact on him. At the time, Diebenkorn was very influenced by Hopper, maybe because his teacher, Daniel Mendelowitz from Stanford, was also a fan of Hopper. Quickly thereafter, though, Diebenkorn enlisted in the Marine Corps, and he went to the East Coast, and he was stationed at Camp Quantico, and he spent time at the Phillips Collection in Washington, D.C., and that's where he saw Studio Quai Saint-Michel, which is in the show, and it's the first painting you see when you walk into the exhibition, and it's really quite stunning. And Diebenkorn and his wife, Phyllis, really said that that painting took things beyond for both of them and was really when their love of Matisse and lifelong scholarship of the artist's work really took hold.
He was also in Los Angeles and incorporated a lot from seeing some of Matisse there, as we learned from the show, and mainly moved toward abstract painting to the large degree, yeah?
Yes. One thing that that Janet speaks about and Katie Rothkopf, the other curator of the show, speak about in their essays in the catalog is Diebenkorn's very unique and strong sense of visual memory. In 1952, he saw a Matisse exhibition, retrospective exhibition, at the L.A. County Memorial Galleries, and it wasn't an there actually was really a almost a department store that was turned into a gallery space at the time. At that moment, he saw Goldfish and Palette, for example, which is a really stunning Matisse painting. And it's important to remember that Diebenkorn did not buy the very famous catalog for this exhibition by Alfred Barr until 1954. But between 1952 and 1954, he painted some works that harken back to Goldfish and Palette so strongly. And it was as if the orange in the painting, in Matisse's painting, was really seared into Diebenkorn's mind. And he was able to take those colors and move past abstraction and figuration and into his own personal style.
So you see the whole trajectory there. I mean,
yes.
And in fact, it comes to you as a viewer when you go to the MoMA show. In fact, let me go back, if I may, to you, Janet Bishop. There's this dialectic almost, and I think to some extent Daisy touched on it in Diebenkorn's work. He goes from abstract to figural, and he's kind of not necessarily in sync with, I mean, he's doing figural when abstract is big in New York, and he's doing abstract when pop art is kind of bringing in more figural. And what's fascinating about that to me is one of the finest modern painters, that is Diebenkorn, but less known for many years and not given the recognition because he was here on the West Coast. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is a kind of almost, I don't know if I use the word discrimination, but it might be apt. You know, New York was the scene and New York was where everything was vested in terms of the art world.
Mm-hmm. Right. So when Diebenkorn really came of age as a painter, he was an abstract expressionist. And so Daisy was speaking of the paintings that he made when he was teaching in Urbana, Illinois, just after his experience of the 1952 Matisse retrospective in Los Angeles. And that's when we first see evidence of Matisse, his interest in Matisse, come through really clearly in his own canvases. Diebenkorn then moves back to the Bay Area and settles in Berkeley and spent a couple years making extraordinarily robust abstract expressionist canvases that are titled for his new home city. And then he shifted to figuration. And that was, as you were saying, Michael, it was an interesting choice at that time because avant-garde painters across the country, both on the West Coast and in New York and at places in between, were making abstract paintings. And in fact, Phyllis Diebenkorn, Diebenkorn's wife, said something interesting when he made the change, that she almost thought that seeing paintings of figures was a little square at the time. It sort of took her a while to get used to it. It was sort of stunning. She'd been so trained to understand that avant-garde painting was abstract. But he really had he was doing really well as an abstract expressionist painter, and his Berkeley paintings were very highly regarded. But as he explained it, if he had been intending to continue in that vein, he was really consorting with the wrong company because his closest friends were David Park and Elmer Bischoff, and they had made the switch to painting figuratively, and really that's where the fun was.
Well, you mentioned his wife Phyllis. They met at Stanford, and there is a lot of close connection. I mean, he grew up in the Ingleside Terrace district. He's a local boy in many ways. He went to Lowell High School and then went to Stanford, UC Berkeley, was at the San Francisco Art Institute. The reality, though, is that he was kind of branded, wasn't he, as a California or New Mexico writer? Because when he flew over Albuquerque, mm-hmm. he had a whole kind of epiphany there. So he incorporated a lot of that into his work. And I think it kept him from later on, of course, in his later years, I think he got the recognition certainly that he deserved. I mean, as a major world figure in painting. But to some extent, I'm a literary guy. I think about New York and publishers, and I think about New York and art, and I realize that to some extent there's a siloing effect that goes on. But let's talk about, again, the relationship between Diebenkorn and Matisse, because it's a strong one, and it's pointed out here in the show that we're talking about that's at the MoMA. For the most part, they're labeled – let me just go to you on this, Janet. I mean, one's labeled a post-impressionist, one labels a modernist, and they continue to have those labels, though there's a tremendous sense of versatility in what Diebenkorn puts on the canvas, which is what we've just been saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, he's sort of famously known for going from abstraction to figuration and then back again with his very large-scale, luminous Ocean Park paintings that conclude the exhibition.
Which look like a lot of Matisse's work. I mean, in terms of the influence, you can see it. I don't mean this is derivative or anything, but the influence is there.
Yeah, there's a really interesting relationship between Matisse and Diebenkorn in that Ocean Park series. Diebenkorn had the experience in 1966 of another Matisse retrospective in Los Angeles, this one at UCLA and consisting of some 350 objects. So it was a sprawling survey. And in interviews, he noted a few paintings that were especially important to him. One was Matisse's View of Notre Dame from 1914, and the other Matisse's French Window at Collioure, also from 1914. These are among the most radical paintings by Matisse that have ever been displayed. Neither one was likely to have been finished by the artist, but they were both sent to the exhibition by the artist's family and had a big impact on Diebenkorn. And I think you can see in the structure, the color, the relationship between flat planes and lines, horizontals, verticals, and diagonals, that there's a really deep connection to Diebenkorn.
And Daisy Murray-Holman, what about that deep connection in terms of the switch to still lifes and interiors and city scenes and, again, figural work?
Well, beginning in the late 50s and really in 1960s, there was this incredible crescendo of Diebenkorn's exposure to Matisse, really culminating in 1964 at the end of the year when he was sent to the USSR with his wife Phyllis as a cultural representative of the United States.
They went to the Hermitage, right?
He went to the Hermitage, yeah. And he saw the Moroccan triptych, and he was also in Moscow at the State Museum there. But right before that, in that summer, Diebenkorn's father had passed away, and he really mined his love of Matisse's still lifes and Cézanne's as well when he drained all color from his palette and turned to very moody black and white still lifes that his daughter Gretchen will really say reflect a tremendous loss for him. So at that moment when he was feeling emotionally raw, he goes to the Soviet Union and he is exposed to these Matisses, which he knew were there, but really no one, especially in his peer group, no one had seen. So he felt like he was getting in at the ground floor, and he was brought up to the attics of the Hermitage, and he was shown with a flashlight, a painting on a wall in the stairwell. And he felt that it wasn't just seeing the works, but it was also the moment that his works were already beginning to flatten out. The course of his work seemed to happen without him knowing that something was going to change. And then in 1960, when he comes back from the Soviet Union...
Excuse me, he also went to the Pushkin Museum?
Yes, he also went to the Pushkin Museum, yes. When he came back, his studio, which in Oakland was condemned for the building of the BART, and then in 1966 he sees the UCLA retrospective, and then he moves to Los Angeles and begins the Ocean Park series thereafter. So things started to move very quickly, and his work changed alongside of that.
There was a Berkeley period, there was a Santa Monica period.
Yes.
I mean, and it depended, you know, what environment he was in and where he lived. You mentioned his daughter just a moment ago, Gretchen Diebenkorn Grant. What I was most struck by in just reading about his background, he had a great collection of art books, but guess which artist he had in books more than anyone else? It turned out it was Matisse.
Yes.
I mean, there again is more of, a recognition of just how important the influence was. And And influence has to do, Janet, a good deal with composition. It has to do with, as you said, geometry, with light. I mean, you can see all that. But also, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't. I read, you know, the essay by Jody Roberts, which is in the new book that's out about these two great artists. It's called Breaking All the Rules. They were both really, as far as subjects, more involved in painting bodies of women than just about anything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a period between 1955 and 1967 or so when Diebenkorn and Matisse share subject matter. This is the period of time when Diebenkorn was known as a Bay Area figurative artist. And the female figure was absolutely a primary subject for both of them. Diebenkorn made quite a few paintings that started off with more than one person in the composition, but the second person often got painted out. We have one painting in the show where you see a male figure and a female figure in a kind of ambiguous relationship with each other, but mostly it's just one figure, and often they're in very contemplative poses, very candid, casual, and there's some really extraordinary works in the show.
I was thinking also of that work where you have a reclining model with a flowered robe, and compared to Diebenkorn, women in a chair drawing. There's also, you know, just a lot of these paintings that really it's almost as if – tell me about this, Janet. I mean, you're showing – like a conversation between these two painters. You wanted to kind of emote that, didn't you?
So the two pieces you just mentioned are both in our drawings gallery, and they actually sparked my co-curator on the project, Katie Rothkopf, from the Baltimore Museum of Art, to really want to put these two artists in dialogue with each other. The works were made decades apart, you know, in two different continents by two different hands, but they really have a close connection in the composition and the relationship between the artist and the model, this very sort of easy rapport that you sense between the two. And then they also have these flowered fabric that they're, you know, that they're covered by, and it's a really pretty startling dialogue that you see.
It is startling. It's also There's a quote in that book from Keats, Marginalia to Paradise Lost, you know, about one mind imagining into another, one of the most mysterious kind of phenomena that we can at least detect in art and in so many other things, but especially where creative endeavors are concerned. Both also, let me just go to you on this if I could, Daisy Murray Hoffman with us, Holman with us, head of the archives of the Richard Diebenkorn Foundation. A lot of identification with both with change and with corrections.
Yes. One of the wonderful things that we at the Foundation have been able to do is share our collection of works, which really show Diebenkorn's continual return to pieces with curators like Janet. And Diebenkorn had a lot of trouble saying that something was finished, and he really didn't like to allow a body of work outside of his out of his studio unless it was complete. And we have found in letters between himself and his first New York dealer, Ellie Poindexter, that she would want him to send him pieces one by one. He would say, absolutely not. I have to leave everything here until I know it's absolutely complete, and then I can send you an entire body. Gretchen Diebenkorn Grant, Richard Diebenkorn's daughter, who lives here, and the foundation is very close with the family. And Phyllis Diebenkorn, Richard Diebenkorn's widow, was really our beacon and supported the creation of our catalog Resonate, which is a compendium of all of Diebenkorn's unique works, which was just published. And Gretchen has this story where she had a work in her house and she knew that her father wanted to get back to it. And then one day, Thanksgiving dinner or some family dinner, Diebenkorn asked Gretchen's son if he could bring him to the work. And a few hours later, she saw this very sneaky look on her father's face. And he went in and just covered up a little part of the piece that was hanging in Gretchen's house. So,
it's a wonderful story. But it also reminds me, when we talk about Diebenkorn, I think about somebody like Faulkner who said, you know, The Sound of Fury was never done in his mind. He had to go back and write an appendix about 17 years later.
And it also brings up that French Window Couleur is not known if it was ever finished. right?
The Matisse painting,
yes,
that you're speaking of that has it has vertical bands of gray and blue and aqua on the sides, and then this black panel in the center. And it was almost certainly not finished. If you look carefully, you can see the evidence of a balcony of a railing, and that he covered over in black and then left in his studio for many, many years. But finished or not, it was important to Richard Diebenkorn when he saw it.
Yes.
He also wound up living in Healdsburg, and there was a tremendous influence at that stage of his life by Cézanne, wasn't there?
Yes, and from the Diebenkorn's porch in Healdsburg, you can see Mount St. Helena, and it looks quite a lot like Cézanne's mountain in France. So we can see Diebenkorn returning again and again to his references and his inspirations, and never shying away from acknowledging that Mont-Saint-Victoire, Cézanne's mountain, meant something to him. And he was attracted to finding that place again in his life. And his family was always along for the ride.
I'm sorry, it's probably a result of talking a little bit before we went on the air about connection between literature and art. But, you know, Hemingway was one time, especially when he wrote The Sun Also Rises, called a Cézanne of the countryside, because that writing, you know, is really right out of Cézanne. I want to find out, though, if I could, about – well, let me do this. We're coming up on a break here, and I want to give listeners not only an opportunity to join us in conversation. In fact, invite you. We're tweeting out some pictures that we're discussing. You can follow along. Our handle is at KQED Forum, or use the hashtag Matisse Diebenkorn. Diebenkorn, of course, spelled Diebenkorn. And go to our website, kqed.org/forum. We have paintings that actually Daisy mentioned on our website. We have a number of other paintings of both artists. Would love to hear those of you, maybe even those of you who are completely unfamiliar with either of these artists, your response to the paintings and your response to seeing them, you know, in tandem, these two artists who have a half a century separating them and who never met. Should mention, in fact, that Matisse was introduced to San Francisco for the first time right after the earthquake, and there was a good deal of shock at the brushwork and just the color of his work. But, of course, Diebenkorn was a local, as we've said, and we do want to hear from you, whether you're listening to us locally or otherwise, not only your response, but I know some of you are interested in these two artists, not only their connections, but interested in their work individually, and we do want to hear from you. So join us now at our toll-free number. I invite you to do that. That number is 866-733-6786. We do welcome your calls and certainly would like to hear from you. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum at kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at kqedforum, or go to our Facebook page. Many ways for you to become part of this problem. Janet Bishop with us, Thomas Wiesel, family curator of painting and sculpture at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. She co-curated the Matisse Diebenkorn exhibition, which is what we're talking about here. Daisy Murray Holman, also here with us, head of archives with the Richard Diebenkorn Foundation. And you, again, can join the program. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. San Francisco MoMA has a Matisse Diebenkorn exhibit. It tells a story of study and inspiration and of where these two artists really connect in so many ways, particularly the influence of Matisse on Diebenkorn. We're talking with the co-curator, Janet Bishop, and also with Daisy Murray Holman, who is head of archives with the Richard Diebenkorn Foundation. And I should mention that when Diebenkorn died, I happened to look at his obituary, and he was described as a lyrical painter, which I thought was in the New York Times obituary. Some of you who know the work of either of these artists may want to weigh in here. And in fact, if you've seen the exhibit, you may want to give your impressions of it. Or again, I'm urging you to go to our website, or we're tweeting out some of the pictures, and I'd like to hear your responses to them. We do want you to be involved in this discussion, and you can join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786, or email us, forum at kqed.org, or go to our website at kqed.org/forum and put your questions or comments there, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at KQE Forum. Looking at a tweet here. PSA, the SF MoMA is open until 9 p.m. tonight, and on every Thursday, those aged 18 years and under get in free. Sweet deal. Great opportunity to visit. All right, so that's out there. In the meantime, let me bring your calls in, and let's start off with Steve. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm interested in the experts' understanding of how, whether Diebenkorn or Matisse, have abandoned one of their works for several years or decades, and they come back to it, and how the past change in their attitude towards the piece or their perspective is apparent as they've evolved and their tastes have changed.
Let's go to you, Daisy, first on Diebenkorn and that. And we'll see what we can find out from Jenner about Matisse.
Yes. Well, Diebenkorn was, while he did return to his works over sometimes a period of years, he did seem to remain consistent within his style while he was working on a piece. I wouldn't say that he moved from, once he had moved into Ocean Park series, that he would have gone back to work on a figurative work, because he left that period behind because it became too difficult and too easy at the same time.
And Matisse? Janet Bishop?
Well, I just want to add one thing about Diebenkorn, which is that he had a small group of Indian miniatures that he collected and kept in his home from residence to residence. He bought them in the 1950s. And as part of the family lore, we understand that he actually went in and changed part of one of the Indian miniatures because
yes.
he thought it might be better served by a different color in the background. So he certainly had strong views about what made a work of art correct. Matisse, it's a good question about going back into things. But one thing that is really striking with both artists is the way that they were willing to show so much evidence of process in a final work of art. Neither one of them felt like they needed to make a perfectly complete, pristine surface. And so what we see with both Matisse and Diebenkorn is lots of evidence of the making of the work of art, where you see many, many layers and changes in decision making throughout. So, for instance, one of the paintings in our very first gallery is a portrait of Sarah Stein. And we know that Matisse moved the eyes. He changed the forehead. He dropped her neckline. He raised her gown.
Early photoshopping.
All kinds of things between an earlier version of the piece and the final work of art. So it was something he did with some regularity.
And let me thank Steve for his call and go right to another caller. Peter, that's you. You're on with us. Good morning.
Yes. Good morning. This is a fascinating discussion and a brilliant exhibition. I just want to congratulate those involved. I had a question about the labels next to the paintings in the exhibition, and whether those labels are a result of the education department or they are the curator's choices.
Janet Bishop?
The labels were drafted by curators at the Baltimore Museum of Art and adapted for the San Francisco presentation.
Okay. What's at the heart of my question is it seems to me that the labels were rather heavy and implying a derivative quality of Diebenkorn and from the Matisse's work, and in a way did not sort of acknowledge Diebenkorn's independence as an original artist.
I could see where he could come to that conclusion.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, I would say that we were interested in pointing out the connections, but are absolutely convinced that Diebenkorn took what he saw in Matisse and really used it to his own ends and made it his own. And that's what we hope people will take away when they look at the work side by side.
And Peter, I thank you for the call. Let me go back to you, if I may, Daisy Murray Holman. Let's talk about Diebenkorn's use of color. When he was teaching in Urbana, Illinois, he said he saw nothing but haystacks and craved color. So the story is, and I don't believe it's just apocryphal, he blacked out his windows and painted from his imagination.
Yes, and that was the only time he ever did that in his career. Natural light was incredibly important to Richard Diebenkorn. And actually, Diebenkorn did live in New York, in New York City and in New York State at two different moments in his life, one in 1946-47 and one in the summer of 1953. And one of the reasons after the summer of 1953, while Phyllis and him, why they came returned to the Bay Area, was because he didn't like the lifestyle that you were up so late at night that you slept all day, and he felt that that meant that he missed the daylight hours in his studio. He was really a 9-to-5 worker because he wanted to have his studio windows with no blinds, northern light, and that directly influenced his paintings. But in Urbana, he was uninspired, but also something that becomes very clear in the exhibition is he was really inspired by Matisse at that moment. After being in Albuquerque, where he was from 1950 to 1952, where he received his MFA, and with this, the sandiness and the red of those tones, going to Southern California and seeing the 1952 Matisse show and then going to Urbana, and the contrast between the bright, saturated Matisse colors with the softer tones that he was using in Albuquerque really came to a head, and he needed to block everything out outside.
Did he ever paint in black and white? I think when his father died, you alluded to that before. Is that maybe the only time he painted in black and white?
Well, he drew in black. Well, after his father died in 1964, there is only one painting from that year. So it was really one of the only years where painting was not a part of his repertoire. And there are paintings, especially from Albuquerque, that are not saturated with color, that do feel that they have a real tonality that is based between black and white, or really focused on browns and yellows and ochres. And then moving to Urbana, and all of a sudden, he said, there's green and there's blue, and it becomes huge.
We're talking, if you've just joined us, about Diebenkorn, Richard Diebenkorn, and Henri Matisse. There is at the San Francisco MoMA, the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, an exhibit that tells the story of the connections between these two artists. I think Diebenkorn described his firsthand encounters with Matisse. We've been kind of tracing them as essentially moments of recurring epiphany, and that, I suppose, speaks volumes here. We're also interested in hearing your thoughts, and you can join us toll-free 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org or go to our website, which is kqed.org/forum. And again, urging you listeners to go to our website and look at some of the paintings that Amanda Stupai has dutifully posted there and get your impressions, get your thoughts. A listener writes, is it true that Diebenkorn once had a studio in downtown Oakland in an old commercial building and that he painted part of what became the Ocean Park series while he was there, or is that just a local urban legend?
He had a studio, but the Ocean Park paintings were painted in Santa Monica. So the Oakland studio that you're referring to is called the Triangle Studio, and there's some really extraordinary Bay Area figurative paintings that were made in that space. It had a very distinctive red and gray checkered linoleum floor that shows up in a number of those pieces.
I can't help thinking when we're talking about influences on Diebenkorn. I mentioned Cézanne later on and so forth, but there are a lot of comparisons to someone who was a contemporary of his, de Kooning. I mean, was there mutual influence there as well, you think, Janet?
Yeah, I think, well, Diebenkorn was a really astute student of many, many artists. So artists that came before him and his peers, and his interest in de Kooning, I think, shows up, you know, primarily in his abstractions of late 1940s and 50s.
The comment from Joe says, thanks for the show on Matisse's influence on Diebenkorn. I just recently discovered Diebenkorn, but this adds a whole new layer to his work. And some questions. Kevin says, it sounds like developing the West Coast avant-garde art scene was something of a family affair, another reason to be proud to be from Berkeley. I wonder if there's anything more to it than location and coincidence. Was there much public support of his early work, or was it patronized on a strictly private basis?
Well, one thing that we have
Daisy Holman
really worked on, I'm speaking from the Richard Diebenkorn Foundation's perspective and the research that we've done for the creation of our catalog Resonate, is that Diebenkorn, from a very early age, was supported by his professors, by his teachers. He was the youngest professor at the California School of Fine Arts, which became the San Francisco Art Institute when he returned from World War II in 1946. He spent one semester there as a student, and then he was hired as an instructor. And Douglas McKagey, who was the director of the school after World War II, immediately saw promise in Diebenkorn. And in 1948, Diebenkorn had a solo show at the Legion of Honor when he was sandwiched between artists like David Park and Clifford Still and Mark Rothko, who are also having solo shows at the same time. And at the time in 19... 19-
and forgive me, Clifford Still was one of his teachers, too. You know?
David, he was not actually a teacher of Diebenkorn, but he was a teacher alongside Diebenkorn, which is quite remarkable because Clifford Still was already a monumental figure in abstract expressionism at that moment. And he had, as we were discussing over the break, a real following at the California School of Fine Arts. And Diebenkorn, who was just a 26-year-old guy who'd just come back from World War II and really had only studied art at Stanford and for one semester at UC Berkeley, he was on par. He became a peer very quickly.
And we should mention, when you're talking about his service in the military, he was a Marine, I believe, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
Robert writes, the chief feature that I associate with Richard Diebenkorn's breathtaking pictures is sunlight. How has the work of Henri Matisse contributed to this aspect of Diebenkorn's paintings and in that of other second-generation figurative artists? Janet Bishop?
Well, both Matisse and Diebenkorn were fascinated by the relationship of interior and exterior. Neither one of them tended to paint sort of pure landscapes where you didn't see either figures or some evidence of the built environment. They were much more interested in the relationship between nature and architecture, interior, exterior. And so there are many paintings in the exhibition that show that. You'll have a figure sitting on the porch in Nice in Matisse's interior from 1919 or 1920, looking into a room. There's Diebenkorn's Girl with Plant, where she's looking out a window. But sunlight was really important. And one of the most striking places we see this is in the pairing between interior with violin, Matisse, and Richard Diebenkorn's interior with doorway, where we have very dark interiors and very bright bright exteriors. And that contrast is really extraordinarily beautiful.
I don't know if it was you, Janet, but I said when I was going through the tour that I'm old-fashioned enough to probably prefer Matisse to Diebenkorn. And was it you who said, somebody said to me, just the opposite with Neil Ben Ezra.
Interesting. Well, Neil, after seeing the show at its first venue in Baltimore, said,
He's the director of MoMA, we should say. Yeah.
He saw the exhibition at its first venue at the Baltimore Museum of Art, and he said, I wonder if we should call it Diebenkorn Matisse.
Yeah. That's. Bob writes, a wonderful surprise in the exhibit was the room of drawings, a great focus on their working processes. There are many times that it's hard to tell who did which drawing. Can your guest comment on this, please?
Well, it's funny that to get that comment, because as I was walking out the exhibition out of the galleries the other day, I overheard some visitors saying, you know, I couldn't tell. And they were speaking about the drawings in particular. And that is a place where I think they're especially close. The drawings have a real sort of intimacy about them and a lot of resonances in general approach.
I don't want to sound like the advance man for this exhibit. Obviously, I liked it, but there's also a coda in the exhibit that we should mention, where you have some, well, local painters like Bechtel and Thibault, and talk about that. What was the purpose of it?
Well, so the Matisse-Diebenkorn exhibition consists of 10 galleries, and then at the end we have a sort of bonus space. It was important to me to share that this notion of artistic inspiration continues, and that both Matisse and Diebenkorn have been profoundly important to many other artists. So we've presented a group of 6 objects, most from SF MoMA's permanent collection, that connect in one way to one or both artists. Thibault, for instance, that you mentioned, Michael, we're showing his Sunset Streets painting from the 1980s, and Thibault was the first to acknowledge that Diebenkorn's cityscapes were really important to him, and that he then went on to further exaggerate the verticality of San Francisco's hilly landscape and make that a really major part of his output for decades.
You talk about all these influences on Diebenkorn, though. I mean, we mentioned Cézanne and even contemporary like de Kooning. Those still lifes, you could do a whole curating thing of those still lifes and late still lifes of Manet. Mm. And I mean, there are some, again, some remarkable parallels there, and you can see influence and so forth. Faye asks, Diebenkorn lived through big art movements. Was his work criticized or dismissed at any point in time? Let me go to you on that.
Yes. Well,
This is Daisy Murray Holman. Yeah.
While Diebenkorn was successful from a very early age and his work was appreciated, especially when he made the switch from his Berkeley series, which was a series of very lush abstract expressionist works. He had his first solo show in New York in 1956 of those work, and his next solo show 2 years later in 1958 was all figurative paintings. And he had a collector who called him up and said, "You've ruined my investment." So he really was, at the time, did receive a lot of flack for leaving the cause and maybe returning to something that some considered to be more traditional, less avant-garde. But as Janet said, he was associating with figurative painters, and he just felt that the abstract expressionist mode for him was becoming tougher and tougher, and he was interested in quite possibly the restrictions that figurative art had for him. And
so it's part of forging his own style, really. He just kept going from one avatar to another. Yeah.
Absolutely. And the drawing room in the exhibition is so beautiful, and it points out the relationship between the figurative drawings and of Diebenkorn's and the figurative drawings of Matisse. But Diebenkorn also was a prolific draftsman in abstract mode, but you can see Matisse's influence in his abstract drawings as well. So he was thinking of Matisse at every moment in his career, in whichever mode he was working in.
And let me bring more of our callers in here. We go next to William. Good morning. You're on Forum.
Oh, good morning. I just had a comment about the relationship between Diebenkorn and Matisse. He is described as echoing form and color of Matisse, but if you really stand back and study, you'll find that Diebenkorn pretty much copied him, color and composition, and I think it should be described that way.
Well, the word derivative is used from time to time. What do you think about this, Janet? Let's get you on.
I would beg to differ. I think that that Diebenkorn really has his own touch. I mean, there's no question that he was inspired. There's no question that he felt a really strong connection to Matisse's color and composition and way of fitting the various elements together on a canvas to make a complete painting. But in looking at the works together, I would say that, you know, to my mind, it's not at all difficult to distinguish who did what. That they may collapse somewhat. That may be more difficult in the drawings, in the drawings room. But the paintings, I think, are you know, Richard Diebenkorn's paintings really, really show his own voice. And one interesting question that people have had for me is, you know, whether Diebenkorn would have been the same painter without the precedent of Henri Matisse. And I would say for sure he would not have been the same painter, but he would have been a heck of a painter. He would have been a really good painter.
Let me thank the caller. And Andy writes, Diebenkorn's absorption of Matisse's approach to color, form, and design reminds me of the way the great Spanish artist Velázquez took on aspects of both Caravaggio and Titian, without losing his own identity. That's really what you're talking about.
Yeah, I don't think Diebenkorn loses his identity. The place where he comes closest in painting to me is in the Recollections of a Visit to Leningrad. It's the piece that he made after the trip to the USSR that Daisy was speaking of, and where there's a very decorative floral passage that you see in the upper left-hand corner of that painting. But interestingly, because of the great work of the Diebenkorn Foundation, we know that that particular pattern, while it speaks pretty directly to Matisse, comes from an Indian bedspread that Richard Diebenkorn and his wife had thrown over their couch. And there's a picture of them in the archive sitting on that couch with that exact fabric.
Another caller, John, is joining us. John, you're on Forum. Good morning.
Hi, yes, I'm calling from Oakland. I grew up in the Buffalo, New York area with a strong relationship with the Albright Knox Art Gallery there. And my question has to do with the three-way relationships between major museums, the artists, and the public. While I was in Buffalo, Clifford Still had a major show there and so loved the way that his paintings were hung. That's where many of his major paintings were, and I just grew up seeing Still in addition to Pollock and Tanguay, and developed a very strong relationship, which wouldn't exist if those museums didn't feature those artists. And my question has to do, particularly with Diebenkorn, had there been museums, and we're very, very, blessed to have the MoMA here and have the show here, and I haven't had that kind of relationship with Diebenkorn. So have been other museums that have featured Diebenkorn, particularly in the United States, that have fostered both his ability to show to the public and perhaps the public perception of Diebenkorn?
His work has been Diebenkorn's work has been featured by many museums over the years. There's been retrospectives at SF MoMA, at the Whitney Museum, at the Albright Knox. And in fact, we just had the former director of the Albright Knox, Bob Buck, come see the Matisse Diebenkorn exhibition with us yesterday. And SF MoMA is really honored to be the caretakers of one of the great collections of Diebenkorn's work anywhere in the world. So we have his work from the early 1940s, through the Ocean Park period. So,
and again, this exhibit has 60 of his works, I believe,
yes.
Right?
Right.
40 of Matisse's. Thank you for the call, John. Susan says, could you speak to Diebenkorn's motivation to paint? He told The New Yorker back in the 1980s that he never dreamed of getting a dealer or painting for history. Daisy Murray Holman?
Well, earlier in the show, we spoke about how, in a way, Peter Sells, who's a great art historian and curator and is from the Bay Area, and he curated the New Images of Man show at the Museum of Modern Art in New York in 1957, and he referred to Diebenkorn as coming from the hinterlands. So Diebenkorn, while he...
That's how they regard the West Coast.
Yes, how they regard the West Coast. But he was so inspired to paint, and he wasn't interested in the fame, and he wasn't interested in going to the gallery openings, and he wasn't interested in putting his name out there, because painting to him was his primary job. That inspiration carried him through a over 40-plus long-year career. I mean, he really started drawing when he was a very young boy.
He also had a great work ethic. I mean,
yes.
He was steadfast.
Both Diebenkorn and Matisse were quite prolific.
Yeah.
And it says something. We have Matisse Diebenkorn. When you have a show that takes two artists and puts them together, you really are only able to see a selection of their work because you're looking at their work in concert with each other. And one thing that we've found through the creation of the catalog Resonate is that Diebenkorn's influences were vast, but Diebenkorn never stopped working. And every day he was sitting and he was drawing, and his children tell stories of him constantly having a sketchbook in his hands. And he would use his wife as his model, and Phyllis would be drinking a cup of coffee and he would say, "Hold it." And he would take out his sketchbook and draw her right then, because it was this insatiable urge to capture his life. And one thing is that he was a very intellectual man, but he wasn't very articulate. So through art and through his hand, he could express himself. And that really sets him apart as an artist who was more interested in that expression than speaking for himself.
Actually, there's a tweet here from Lynn who says, "I've been hearing about the catalog Resonate for years. Can't wait to see it. Wonderful to see these links to Diebenkorn's influences." And a question from a listener says, "At one time I heard from the family that Diebenkorn had made miniature paintings for his granddaughter Phyllis's dollhouse. Have you heard of these, and do they appear in the catalog Resonate?"
Yes, we have heard of them, and I've been lucky enough to actually see them and hold them in the palm of my hand, because they really are the size of matchboxes. And Diebenkorn, as Gretchen said, he didn't think you should have a house without artwork. So he made small works for his granddaughter, Phyllis Grant. And of course, they're in the catalog Resonate, because the catalog Resonate, we hope, knock on wood,
pretty inclusive.
Is is as comprehensive as it can be, which is, of course, is impossible. But we have worked for over 20 years to create a comprehensive listing of all of the unique works by Richard Diebenkorn, which is what a catalog résumé is. And luckily enough, the release of the résumé coincided with the release of the Matisse-Diebenkorn show. So it's really been a privilege to work with Katie Rothkopf and
Good
Janet Bishop.
Serendipity there, too.
Absolutely.
I'd love to add that those tiny little dollhouse-sized ocean parks even have arrows on the back of them to make sure that they're hung correctly in the dollhouse.
Yes.
Kenny wants to know about Marin locations. We're getting local here. But he says, I've always wished I could pinpoint Diebenkorn's exact locations among quotidian Marin landmarks made significant.
Well, there's a Sausalito body of work.
Yes.
Do you know where he was living at the time,
yes,
Daisy?
Yes, he lived on Bulkley Avenue in Sausalito. So I don't want to give up the address, but you should look it up in the catalog résumé or online in their other catalogs that have it. I don't want somebody to get some knocks on their door, which we do know happens because Diebenkorn was a local resident and his previous homes are out in the world.
And people want to make their hermitages.
Yes, they
can. And they can do it through the work. Go see the exhibit. It's at the SF MoMA. It is really worth seeing. And particularly, I urge those who don't necessarily know these artists very well. You can learn an immense amount. I did. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you, Michael.
Very much.
Janet Bishop, again, is Thomas Wiesel, family curator for painting and sculpture at the SF MoMA and co-curated the Matisse-Diebenkorn exhibit and exhibition, I should say. And Daisy Murray-Holman is head of the archives of the Richard Diebenkorn Foundation. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Always like to hear from you. If you have thoughts about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear, you can email us, forum@kqed.org. And remind you that tomorrow Mina Kim will be at the microphone again. And please tune into the Forum program tomorrow from 9 to 11. Thank you for being a part again of today's program and for all of us here at KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.